Greetings, Rays community. Brent coming in live with today's guest, Matt Bethay, who serves as Vice President for University Advancement at Sam Houston State University. Welcome, Matt.
Hey, Brent. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to come and talk with you a little bit.
Well, Matt and I had the opportunity to connect in real life at the CASE Summit just about a month ago. And I promise you, Matt, this recording won't be quite that much fun, but we're going to do our best.
Okay. I appreciate that. Yeah, I don't know if anything could top that.
Yeah, it was really a great gathering. We had the opportunity to bring together a group of kind of Evertrue customers, friends, partners, and our colleague Keith Maneri hosted an incredible Long Island wine tasting. So that was our attempted stewardship for you all, Matt.
Yeah, we appreciate that. Good company. I get to meet some individuals I probably wouldn't have met before. And the wine was New York wine actually tastes pretty good.
There you go. I think like Texas Hill Country, maybe underappreciated wine region for sure.
Yes, for sure.
Excited to share, you know, your story with our community. And like I've asked a couple hundred guests at this point, why don't you take me back to junior year of high school? Who was that, Matt? Where were you? And what led you to the University of North Texas?
Oh, man. Junior year, I was in Duncanville High School. I was playing soccer for Duncanville High School. We had just come off a state championship the year prior. So a lot of pressure being put on that team at that point. You know, winning state championships, you're ranked number one when you're coming back the next year. So it was fun. Love the pressure. I had some good teammates. You know, outside of soccer, I was getting to a point where I'd done soccer for most of my life. And I was looking for a change. So I really actually wanted, I had two loves. I wanted to be a fighter pilot and I wanted to be a musician. And so I went to talk to the Marines and the fighter pilot dream went into the trash can when they found out I had a ton of allergies and asthma. And but my second love was music. So I went off to the University of North Texas to pursue a degree in music. And
What kind of music were you into in high school?
I was into metal. I left North Texas because I did join a metal rock band, and we were playing all around Dallas and went on the road a little bit. And
was the name of the band?
It was called Rose, so Roze at the time. So we had Atlantic Records looking at us, we had A&M Records looking at us, and you know, we were in good company with some bands around Dallas. That Pantera was one of the groups that we were friends with, not best friends, but you know, we hung out a little bit. They came to our shows, we went to their shows, Trip and Daisies, things like that. So a lot of these bands that we hung out with got signed, we didn't. So which is probably a good thing for me in the long run. So
I can't ask you all the stories about touring as a metal band in your early 20s, but what are some poignant memories that stand out? That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, so we were playing a venue called the Arcadia Theater in Dallas. We were with probably about eight other bands that were playing. We were the marquee band at the time. And when I came downstairs to get into the dressing room ready for the show, Pantera, Phil and Daryl and Rex were there downstairs, because the band that usually opened up for them were playing before I was. We played our show. We were all hanging out in the back after the show, and there were some guys that were causing trouble, and so it was just my band and Pantera that we were out kind of just doing the things that metal bands would do, getting into fights and things like that. So it was, I can't go into the whole story, but let's just say the individuals who were trying to mess with us and Pantera didn't get the good end of the stick there.
Sounds like it'll be a great chapter in the memoir when you're ready.
Yeah, one day, you know, those days of long hair and metal and everything that comes with being in a band.
The problem, I just did a quick scan to see if I could track down some Rose footage here. I might ask our producer to see if we can get some Pantera or at least some heavy metal lead in or lead out of this
There you go. Yeah,
episode.
there's a Rose video that we played when we were in Dallas, and I would think I was 18 years old. It's on YouTube.
All right, we're going to track that down. I love it, man. So you're,
1989 is when it was.
but
So
you've got this musical dream. I don't often equate like metal and like collegiate academic music study. So how did that mesh up?
I was watching a video on, or I was watching a show on YouTube talking about the generation that I grew up in, and those who listened to metal music or rock music, and actually those who attended these metal concerts and Texas Jam and things like that, actually have done very well for themselves. So whether they all thought we were troublemakers and like there's nothing ever going to amount to any of you guys, and ended up. The survey they did, and I can't remember the name of the show, shows that those who have been a part of the metal scene back then have been truly successful in their careers. So
Well, I
it's kind
can't
of
say I was
amazing.
a part of the metal scene, but as a high school athlete, we absolutely had Pantera rocking in the mid-90s, pretty consistently. And so you sort of have that music experience. Sounds like some local success, some neat exposure for the story you just shared, but didn't quite work out. And so what was the moment when you decided, hey, fun hobby, not my career? What am I going to do with the next chapter?
That moment came when I was dating my who is now my wife, and we were serious. We joke around because I thought I was going to break up with her at one point. But I had to make a decision. Is this the life that I want my girlfriend at the time, or my future wife, to be a part of? And what would that look like for us? And, raising a family that I wanted, just didn't match up, and seeing some friends that have been in the industry, it's probably a good thing that it didn't. There are some of my friends, there's one gentleman who's in Nashville. He's doing very successfully. He's a producer now. We all look at him and he's doing great. But my wife, I wanted to have a life with her, and I wanted to have a family with her, and get a career going. So I did quit the band, and she and I got married, and I actually had to go back and finish my degree to move forward. I was in sales at the time, and so I had a career in sales, and learned that some of the jobs that I wanted, they wanted you to have a college education. So I went and finished it later in life. I tell people I crammed 4 years of college into 20. So, but that was my path. And so I don't regret any of it. I wouldn't change anything. I had a great time and I learned a lot, and just the experiences. And I tell everybody, if my guitar could talk, might tell some stories on me. So,
Man.
but had fun. But
Yeah.
she and I have been together for over 30 years now, and I made the complete right decision.
I love that. That's really I'm grateful for you to share. And I have to ask, at what point, so you sort of re-enter North Texas now. You're the old guy in the class, but get through it. And at what point did you realize that this advancement sector was even a profession? And sort of what was the catalyst to pivot from sales, which is what partly why you went back to school so quickly into this industry that now you've called home for many years.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about. I didn't know there was advancement fundraisers. I didn't know anything about development or anything like that when I was in college, or even when I went back. I was in a sales role. I had a territory that I was working, and I saw a guy that went to my church who was in my territory, and as any good salesman would do, I went to question him on why are you in my territory, and what was he doing? Because at the time, the company I did sales for, it was a recruiting company, and I was outside sales, and I saw him talking to the HR, And so I went to, I saw my church and said, "Hey, I saw you in the Alliance area talking to HR." I said, what do you do?" And he said, I was there talking to an alum for the University of North Texas. I'm in development." And I said, "Well, what does that mean?" And so at church, he's telling me everything that he does. And I said, "Ooh, I could do that because it's similar." And I said, "Are you guys hiring?" He said, "We are." And so he got me an interview. And next thing you know, I'm working for North Texas as Director of Development for Special Projects at in the College of Education. And that's where I started my career.
And so it's really common, right? We have very common stories on this podcast where somebody started as a student caller and then they got, that entry level annual giving role. And then, one thing leads to another. And now they're a senior leader in the team. This story is very unique, where you essentially had a career, return to education, and then stumble into it at church. And so my point is, it's not like you had years and years of kind of grooming, moving up the ladder, and then you became the director of development. And so take me back to that first few months in the role. Was it totally natural, or was it sort of a tough transition? I mean, how would you describe it?
No, I think the transition was an easy transition for me. The pressure at the time in my previous job was immense. My career in my previous job was determined on whether someone wanted to get up and go to a job that morning or not. And so I got into the role, and I tell the story all the time to new development officers. Is North Texas gave me a call sheet of 11 people, and after learning a couple weeks of, I was kind of itching to get going. I was like, "Hey, I don't want to just sit here. I need to do something. I need to call out, and I need to get to see people." But my boss at the time, who is my AVP, Kevin Fralick's wife, she was my boss. And she told me, "Hey, you got to go out and learn about the college." So I did, went out and learned about the college, got my 11 people, and called those 11 people within, 30 minutes. And I called up the research and I said, "Hey, do you have any more people?" And they said, "Why?" And I said, "Because I've already finished making all the calls." So I think the aggressive, my me being so aggressive in the sales industry, I had to kind of tone it back a little bit when it came to donors, because I had called my boss and I said, "So how often should I call donors? Should I call them every day? Should I call them once a week?" And she goes, "Oh no, you should probably call them, maybe two or three times during the month if they don't call you back." And so it just felt easy, the transition. I immediately started talking about North Texas. It was a warm call to me as opposed to the cold calls that I used to have to do in sales. And so it was kind of that easy transition.
I want to talk a little bit more about that, Matt, because this does come up a lot where people will reference, cold calling and advancement. And I've often said, look, the coldest lead that you call an advancement is warmer than most of the leads you would ever get in a traditional sales job. And I think sometimes people are skeptical of that. But like when you think about the marketing funnel, right? Awareness, clearly everybody you're reaching out to is aware, it's on their resume, it's a part of their identity. They talk about it all the time. They talk about it at church. It's just a part of life versus whatever you were selling, prior to getting started, or when I was getting started at Evertrue and nobody had any idea what that was. Like, why would you call?
Man, no one knows. You're walking in, they might know what you do or what your industry was when I was in sales, but they don't know you and you don't know them. And you're getting a name and you're trying to build a relationship with somebody, and then you're asking them for business. And it's quicker when you're asking them for business than it is in fundraising, but it's completely cold. And they don't know you. They don't have any trust in you. It's gonna call, we kind of talked about the nine call rule. After nine calls, nine emails, and visits and stuff, then you kind of move on. But they get calls all the time, but it's completely cold. You're calling somebody that has no idea what you're doing. No, they don't know anything about you. When it comes to the university, you pick up the phone and the person on the other line, just like you said, they probably love Sam Houston. And when I pick up the phone call, our alumni here at Sam Houston, whether it be someone who's already engaged or it's just a cold call for me, so to speak, they still say, "Oh, I had a wonderful time." It's that you're gonna, unless they're just mad at the university, but we get those. But it's not a cold call. Typically with the university, they already have an affiliation with you. It's not like they don't know anything about you. So it's an easier call than it would be if I was doing, selling for Evertrue or selling for, car parts or anything like that, or going door to door. So.
Yeah. No, that's well said. And so it sounds like you had spent enough time in the sales world that once you experienced the warmth, the connection in the advancement world, it was sort of an instant fit. Now, it's one thing to do that for your alma mater. It's another thing to sort of become a professional fundraiser somewhere else. And you made the move to TCU, which was probably right when I was getting to know the folks at TCU, and think super highly of that team. But now you're at a place where you don't have the same experience and know a lot of the things you know by way of your student experience. And so, what was that like relative to fundraising for the alma mater the first time?
When I got to TCU, just being on campus, it was a different atmosphere. It's private, and I sat in my office for the first time on the first day I was there. And I thought, man, I have to be better here than I was at North Texas. This place is serious. This is they're doing the things like, 'cause they were really getting into the big donations, and they had just came off the Rose Bowl win, and it was a private institution. It was Texas Christian University, and it's just automatic pedestal that I felt like, but that was just putting the pressure on myself. I was sitting in the office going, man, did I make the right move? And I just looked at myself and I said, listen, you know what you're doing. They hired you for a reason. Let's get going. And so I did. And I never looked back. I love my time at TCU. The team brought me in, and they just wrapped their arms around me, welcomed me, helped me. I was walking past. I thought the theme at Nord at TCU was, we're glad you're here, because everybody said it. I was walking past the cafeteria one time, and it was my first day, and I heard this guy say, "Hey, you're new here, aren't you?" And I looked at him, I said, "There's no way." I said, "Yeah, I am. Why? How do you know?" And he goes, "I know everybody here." He said, I run the dining hall here, and he said, "Come on by sometime and I'll buy you lunch." And I said, "Fantastic." And I knew I was at a different place. That North Texas, it's bigger than TCU, and there's no way someone like that would have known who I was. But even the student, when he was giving me my ID, he said, "I'm glad you're here." And I was like, wow, this is a different, the warmth and the family that was at TCU was incredible. And the alumni were the same way. They knew why you were calling. And they loved their university. Of course, football helps, right? And so when you're winning Rose Bowls and you're moving up in conferences, and we always have something to talk about, something successful. And it was good. It was great to see this transition at TCU. My foray in there, everybody was just welcoming, and it wasn't a hard transition at all. I drank the Kool-Aid right off the bat. And wore my shirts. I was on vacation in Florida. I had my TCU shirt on. I was in a museum, and someone stopped me and said, "I'm an alum there." And people recognized TCU even in Florida. And so it was just
Any
made me proud to work for them.
favorite memories from your time there?
Yeah, I have. So there's a student who had left TCU to become a sniper in the Marines, and we got a call one day that this former student was killed in Afghanistan. And before he left, he had talked to his dad about, "Hey, I got to get my things in order for my second tour." And he said, "I want to leave money from in my life, my estate planning, for a scholarship at TCU for a student that's getting a degree in history," because he always wanted to be a history professor. And so his dad had called up TCU and said, "Hey, you're going to be getting this gift is going to be realized soon, and you're going to be getting $250,000, and I'm going to match it." And so we got to know this donor's dad, and he came to us and the dean, and he said, "You know, I want to do more for my son, and I would love to give more to the scholarship, or is there something else I need to do?" And the dean knew that this student wanted to be a history and a professor in history. And so the dean said, "You know, we can add to the scholarship and we can help one or two more students a year." But knowing that Benjamin wanted to be a professor in history, we could create a professorship in the college that would carry his name. And that would not only help one student, that would be helping 30 to 40 students a semester. Plus, anywhere that this professor goes to do speaking engagements will carry Benjamin's name. And so we decided we were going to raise money for this project. And the amount of people that were involved, we went down. This doctor worked for the San Antonio Spurs. San Antonio Spurs gave money. We had a lady that read something in the newspaper and sent in a $25,000 gift just for this. We were standing, we had Benjamin's parents in the stadium, and we were working with athletics. And when they were announcing this, you could have heard a pin drop in that stadium. And it was just this incredible feeling. I'll never forget it. I had radio calling me, giving me interviews about what was going on with this. And just the forethought of Benjamin wanting to do this, and then his family, and then everybody that got behind him, this whole project. And so we hired a professor that came in that talked about military history, and she goes around the country talking, and she carries his name with him. And so Benjamin's name will forever be, he's a professor. He has a professorship. And so that to me is just life-changing, not only for students, but just the fact that this student was thoughtful, and now others are going to impact. He's impacting for forever the lives of other students.
A great story, Matt. Thank you for sharing, and one that stands out among the interviews we've done for sure, and a reminder of how important the and unique like the authenticity is when you contrast what you just shared with our earlier discussion around sales, right? You don't get to do that in sales. You don't get to sell, if you will, right, that opportunity, that story, that impact. In any other part of the world. And what a gift to the university, to their family, you know, to Benjamin's legacy, to the students that are going to benefit for years to come. So that's what it's all about.
The owners of the San Antonio Spurs, the part owners, made a gift to it, and I never realized. I sent them a thank you note, but never got to meet them. Come to find out that both of them are Sam Houston alumni, and I said I have to say thank you in person for making that, and they remembered it, and they know who his
Wow.
dad was, and they remember Benjamin, and so it was just a full circle kind of thing. It's kind of weird how it works. But just to meet them and be able to talk to them about the impact that they made on that university.
I
So
love it.
he's funny. Yeah, but they call me all the time now. So I said, well, that's okay. But it's great. Just it's and I have tons of stories I could share,
Yeah,
but
that's
that's
a
what
good.
I tell my team the whole time. I said, listen, what we do is noble. We do noble work. You know, people call us glad handers, and you know, everybody gets nervous when we walk into a room, you know, because we're fundraisers. But our work is noble, and they need to see it that way. We are professionals at what we do. And I tell them all the time, what you do is noble. And remember that when you're going out and when you're visiting somebody or you're making that call and you're pausing. We're here to help our students. We're here to help our university. And, you know, they're not going to be mad at you for you reaching out to them and connecting with them. They're going to be glad you did. And if they are mad, that's okay. You know, what you're doing is noble, and it's behind the scenes. People don't even know that you exist. But just know that when it's all said and done, you're going to look back on your career and you're going to go, you know, we made a difference. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's well said. And look, I think you highlighted a point that we've talked about a decent amount here, which is If they are mad, it's okay. In fact, that's useful information because it means that we can now reallocate our limited time and resources to a new relationship that's more inclined. And I think this is obviously where, right, we want to leverage data, AI, these things as much as we can to right, reduce the odds like that we're going to be going after reaching out to folks that are mad, right, or just negatively oriented around it, because that's no good for anybody. But we, I think disqualification is a win, and just
Absolutely.
understanding, where somebody stands is so much better than not really knowing, not having that connection. So, I think that.
That putting it in the system and making sure that a future there's always that, and we as fundraisers always say, well, we can change that person or we can get them to come around. But in sales, we called it watering the weeds. You're going to ask for business at some point, but if they're not going to do business with you, you're just watering the weeds and you're going to move on. And I don't want to call alumni weeds, but at some point you have to get them off your prospect list. If you're not, you know that they're going to be engaged. You know they're going to be philanthropic through your questioning and your discovery work. And if they're not, then get them off your list and start getting people on your list that are going to be somebody that would be interested in helping our students in the university.
I think that's a great expression, and I bet there are fundraisers listening who where that resonates. And I think the idea of watering the weeds, it's not about them, right? It's about that other person that actually wants to be engaged philanthropically, who isn't getting the attention because that portfolio spot is already taken. And so I think we've just got to, be in that sort of constant, right, qualification, disqualification, and mostly get people out of, what we would call advancement purgatory, which is that in between, and you're just not really sure where they stand. Do they love you? Do they hate you? Are they indifferent? You don't know. Let's
That's
find
right.
out and then let's move forward. So you developed this really, it sounds like tremendous experience at TCU. You gained some confidence that, you do belong, you can do this work, and the opportunity to come back with new perspective and experience and relationships to North Texas and have a really good run there.
Yeah, I did. Almost an 8-year run, moving into an executive director role. I went through a college split, which I don't recommend that to anybody. They took out the college, then we created a College of Science. So I ended up having executive director of liberal arts and social sciences, to being over to two different colleges, and then the journalism school, the journalism became under me, and then I moved up into an assistant vice president role where I learned a lot about foundation and corporate relations, a lot more than I thought I was going to because I took over that team as well. So a lot of experience that I gained at North Texas, at TCU, that helped me get into my role here at Sam Houston State University. So a lot of over close to 20 years of experience, and now I'm being able to lead a team in the way that I've seen others lead. And do the things that I've learned that works, and some things that I don't. I make mistakes, but this is kind of what I want to do, and this is what I think is best for our team. So,
Tell me about in that AVP of development role at North Texas, where you've got multiple colleges splitting, new ones, et cetera. That means a lot of relationships with deans. Tell me about not specific ones unless you want to share, but just great experiences working with deans and then the real challenges of working with deans and how important that is in ultimately driving philanthropy.
So the deans I worked with, I had some great deans. So the dean at TCU, in the liberal arts college there, he and I still talk and still had good friendship. He didn't really know much about fundraising, and he was upfront and honest with me about it. And he said, I need you to teach me how to do this. We had a great run and did some great things for that college. When I was at North Texas, I had a couple deans in the college. And then I worked to transition a dean for the College of Science. He went from being a chair to the new dean for a new college. We had to transition a lot of scholarships. We had to talk to a lot of our donors. He was great to work with, had great ideas, was passionate. A dean that I had in the College of Liberal Arts, when I first got there. Just, I don't think he was comfortable with fundraising, and so he avoided it. And we went on visits, and he was okay. He did what he did, but just giving the amount of time that we needed, I had a situation where I had a donor that we needed to get in front of, and he was like, "I just don't have time." It's like, "But we're gonna ask this gentleman for money, and I need to get it in now, because this is the only time he has." And he said, "Don't. If I don't have time, I don't have time." He got really upset about it, and said, "The only time I can do it is a month and a half away." And I said, "A month and a half away, that's not gonna work." And he said, "That's all I have." So we went down and asked, and I was trying to close the gift. And the donor said, "If you had asked me a month before, I would have been able to do it. But I already given to my buddy, his place is flooded, and he had all this, had already committed what he might have given to us." And it was just frustrating to me. Just when you're trying to work hard and you're trying to build something for that college, and the dean themselves were just, I'm just not interested in this. And you run that into time to time where someone's probably a little afraid to do fundraising and to ask for money. But we have to work around that as well, and we have to give them confidence in it. And it just takes time. And he never really did get the confidence in it. And but the dean that came in after him, she was hungry. I asked her, "What do you know about fundraising?" She goes, "What? Well, I did a conference on fundraising." And I said, "Okay, so we have a lot to learn." And she would do exactly what I'd tell her to do. So we would do role playing. Then we were going to go. This was her first $1 million ask, and we were talking about what's going to happen. And I explained to her. So in sales, I've learned this whole kind of sales technique, and so I walk them through the sales technique, because it works in development too. I said, "Well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to do a little
Take us
chit
through
chat."
it. Yeah, take us
Yeah.
through it. Yeah.
So it's you what we call chit chat. Then you do a bridge to business. You do the business talk, and then you close, answer objections, and then close. And then you answer objections, and then close. And so I told her, I said, "We're going to chit chat a little bit about, what his life is like over there in San Francisco. We're going to talk about the weather and things like that." And I said, "Most likely he's going to try to get us involved with this conversation before we can get to the ask." And I said, "I think he's going to jump us." And when I say jump us, I think he's going to say, "Yeah, everything's great here in San Francisco, nice and sunny. So let's talk about this." And so I said, "Be prepared to get right into it." I said, "We're going to try to lead him into what we want to do," because we were asking him for a larger gift than what we really thought he would give. And I said, "Most likely he's going to say, 'Here's what I'm going to do.'" And everything that I told her. So we did the chit chat. He jumped into the business right away. So I call it a bridge to business, because when you're sitting there talking to somebody and you're talking about their family, you're talking about their times at the university, you can't go, "So, so let's talk about what I'm here for," because it kind of jolts them. And I've seen that when I was in sales before, and my sales manager was like, "Matt, you got to do a better job of that." So what you kind of do is a bridge to business is more like, I know you had a wonderful time, and we were just talking about Sam Houston and your time at Sam Houston. And what I'd really love to talk to you about is how you can be engaged meaningfully, or what your dollars might do, or what you want to do with your donations to really be meaningful to you." And so that's a bridge into what we're about to talk about. But this dean rolled with it. Everything I told her was going to happen, happened. It doesn't always work that way, but it was good. And she did exactly what I asked her to do. She was fantastic with the donor. The donor loved her, and the donor made the gift. And so she had raised her first $1 million right there. And so now she is actually a provost at UTA right now, working with Marie. So she was wonderful to work with. When I saw her sit in front of a donor one time and talk to this donor, I said, "Oh, this is going to be good. We're going to do
Yeah.
some good stuff."
I
So.
love it. Great example of how that partnership can really make a difference, not only in securing the donation, but in creating a quality experience for the donor along the way.
Yeah. Yep. And then now they have a relationship, with they would talk, and she would call and talk about the students that received his scholarship, and he would tear up on what. So she, instead of just sending us We had Thank You at the time. We have Thank You now. And we did send him the students on Thank You video, and he loved it. But
Love
when the dean would talk about the students and what they're accomplishing, and she was doing it personally as well, it just made things, that relationship got strong. And we were, when I was leaving North Texas, we were already talking about what he wanted to do next, which was going to be significant. So,
it.
yeah.
Love it.
And she
So
learned
you
a lot.
move to Sam Houston State. You're a couple years in. Seems like there's a tremendous opportunity, ton of momentum. But I know you had to do, team building as any sort of new leader you would expect needs to do. And just, a couple years in, yeah, maybe give me your I guess early-ish impressions on the experience there so far, what you're excited about.
Yeah, the experience here is it's been fun. It's been a lot of work. We made a lot of changes, and good changes. We had to do a lot of policies and procedures, and we had to move some individuals around, create some new teams. We have to think about different ways of thinking bigger, and getting our alumni to think bigger. The good thing here is that it's kind of it was a total rebuild, and so we're going to be able to accomplish some things. And the whole talk of this is how we have always done it, when I walked in here, I said, I don't want to hear that anymore, because what we've done in the past is in the past, and we're going to change, and we have to change. We had no software. We had nothing when I got here. And everybody, in my interview, they were talking about, we need help. We need the tools to be successful. And, I'm going to give you guys a plug, because at North Texas, we were in the process of hiring you guys to work there. And I knew already who I wanted to work with down here, and who I wanted to bring in. And so that was a tool that we're using. But just the whole, the deans weren't involved in fundraising here. I asked them how many times they had been getting out, and one dean said, I've been out 4 times. And I said, how long have you been here? And he said, 10 years. I was like, oh, okay. So there's no relationship there with advancement and the deans. We have an unusual situation where we are the fundraising team for athletics. Development officers are housed in advancement, not in athletics. So that's a whole learning situation for me, and an interesting one. And there was a just creating opportunities, creating a culture of philanthropy, talking to the cabinet about it's everybody's job to fundraise. We have a lot of work to do still at Sam Houston, but we're moving in the right direction, and the team's excited. The culture has completely changed. Kevin Fralix is our AVP, and he when I was looking for somebody to come down and really change the culture, I thought of one person who could do that. I saw what he did at UNT and the Alumni Center. I heard about what he did at Alabama South, and he also or South Alabama, and he worked at University of Washington, and I love the way the University of Washington does things and how they fundraise. And I said, I want you to bring that here. And
What
so
do
he
you
did.
love about it? How'd you get exposed to what they're doing? That's a long way away.
So, well, I attended the Big Ten fundraising conference a while back. And while I was at North Texas, I thought there's got to be a different way of measuring, creating a metrics that put the behavior where you wanted it. I mean, what's the most important thing of fundraising? You have to ask for money. You can see people all the time, but you have to ask them for the money. And so that was kind of the emphasis. So David Lively, who's at Northwestern, it's interesting. David Lively grew up down the street from me in Duncanville. And I had no idea he was in this industry. And he was talking about his metrics. And I can't remember the gentleman's name. He was the AVP at Michigan, where University of Michigan. But he also worked at the University of Washington, where he learned a lot of what he does. And I love their metrics, how development officers get out and the behavior that they look for when you're fundraising. And I that's what I wanted to do. Plus, Washington, from what I heard at the time, was raising $2 million a day. I thought, okay, if they're doing that, they're doing something right. And he learned it. And I said, bring it here. So, just the fact of I always thought, and in sales, this happens too. When you tell somebody you have to have 150 visits to 200 visits, I understand that, right? You're pushing that behavior, but you're pushing that behavior. And so if you want me, I told my boss at one time, I said, if you want me to see 150 people, I'll see 150 people. But the most important thing to me is how am I seeing the right people? And am I getting to the right people where I can make that ask? So I have to ask so many times, because if I'm gonna have to make 20 asks a year, I'm probably realistically gonna close fit 60% of that. Because so I've got to make more asks. So I wanted to see the right people, right? I wanted to get in front of the right. So I may not have 150 people. My team, I tell them all the time, if you have a portfolio of 20 people and it only takes you 50 visits to do it, fantastic. Then we're getting you the right people to see. I don't want them out making visits that don't them up. It's watering the weeds, right? If I'm gonna get him, I know this person's not gonna give me, but I can get a visit in with this person.
I think you're spot on, Matt. Look, in the end, you can have the best trained person making the right calls with the right bridge to business and making the ask and all of these things, but if they're the wrong names, it's not going to matter. And I think that's where there is such an exciting opportunity here. Obviously, we're heavily invested in it, just around the ability for AI to help us identify the right folks, because there are so many people that are engaged, they're buying tickets. You know, they're fans, they love the place. They've never had a philanthropic conversation. Why? Because nobody's ever reached out to them. Why? Because they haven't been surfaced yet, right? And I think that's where, if we can get the right people into the pipeline at the beginning, and then you still need somebody who sees the list of 11 names and calls them that day, right? And starts, nine touch or whatever it ends up being, Kate, if you will. And that's where. But then also isn't just making the visits, is also making the asks. And I think that's like the sort of dream cycle that we're all working towards and making a lot of progress, where it's the right data, the right names, the right outreach method, the right soft skill conversation piece, and then of course tremendous stewardship.
That's right.
That's what we're all working towards.
Yeah, absolutely. It's that with the help of AI, what really like I was telling you the story about our leadership anti-giving officer using Evertrue to get into in
Yeah,
front
tell that story. We don't usually go too deep into the Evertruth story,
of the
but this one is so good.
Well, I hear from the development team, but she was going to Texas Tech because her daughter's graduating, and she used Evertrue to look up the alumni that were in that area, and she was able to secure, I think Kevin said, and I thought it was nine, eight, but it ended up being like nine appointments, and I was like, my gosh, because I know when I go to places, so there she's using the software to be able to identify the people that she needs to go see, and so she went up there. She brought home a couple gifts. She's using it, and re just recently she brought home a $30,000 gift, and that's a leadership anti-giving officer. And she's a go-getter, and she's using Evertrue. And so it's exciting to see that using the AI. And now that we're in this new era, you showed a lot of things to me when we were at Case, and I was telling the president of the university. It could open up our research department that we're now getting these our major gift officers in front of those who show that they are interested in getting them in the right people, so we can maximize their time.
Yeah, I think just as a company, one of the areas that I think we've got to spend more time on, Matt, is oftentimes like the historical approach at Evertrue was you've got your system, you've got your CRM names, it's not that easy to access, but it's in there, everybody kind of works around it. Let's take that information and let's move it over to Evertrue. And now your portfolio is going to be right easy to access and on your phone. And we can add some enrichment and some additional data signals and help you right be more efficient. I think where we need to take a more assertive role is actually looking at the portfolios in the first place and really helping you all answer the question of, are these even the right names or the best possible names? And I think looking at kind of that that unassigned pool, leveraging as much AI as we can, cross-referencing the assignment spots. It's just we're never going to have enough spots in the portfolio for the quality prospects out there. And so, how do we make sure that we're not water in the weeds, if you will?
It's I think that would be great. I mean, what do we normally do at a university when we're trying to find the right people? We're going where our researchers are on LinkedIn all the time looking for those people. We want to know who's posting, and we look at our social media and say, hey, who's he? So we're doing a lot of this stuff manually. And can we utilize our portfolios a little bit better as we're utilizing Evertrue and we're moving in that to arenas? How do we really focus on, because we have 150,000 live alumni. There's people that have 300 or 200,000, and there's no way a development team's going to get to all those people. But can we through AI pick out those people that we need to contact, and just moving forward in an integrated fundraising model, it's going to need some of that as we move forward,
You
reaching
said,
out to a lot of these people.
yeah, you said, and we do a little pre-interview questionnaire, and you said that you think the next step forward for the industry is integrated advancement. What does that mean to you, and why do you feel that way?
Well, it's and then it may not be everybody's like, we're already doing that. I don't know. We're looking at the journey of an alum, and we want to be a part of that journey from the get-go. So they know who advancement is, and they know what we do at a university, as opposed to waiting. Because anybody that gets a scholarship or works with our team because we want to put them in front of the donor knows what we do. But a majority of the alumni don't have any idea that there's a development team out there. I'm working with our alumni association that we're creating opportunities to help with recruiting. So we want to grow our enrollment numbers. We want to utilize our alumni to go into schools or to go to some of these events and answer questions, because the alumni talk about the university better than I can, and better than our development team. We want to help recruiting. We want to get these students in front of our alumni. Then we want to do a send-off party for them when they get on campus. We want them to join, and we're working with our student affairs to market the students so they join our student alumni association. We want to do a senior toast. We also want to utilize our networks in the alumni association. We can do a welcome home, and we can welcome them back to home, and they could either work with our alumni to get jobs, or just have that family of Bearcats there to welcome them. And then we want them, and we don't charge for annual memberships anymore. They are a member of the alumni association, but we want them to engage, and we want to be there through their life. Typically, and in my whole career, you waited till someone's 50, 55, finally reached a point in their career where they now can be philanthropic, but we were never there when they were first getting married or having their kids, or
Yeah.
going up through the career. We just waited until they were good enough to, or wealthy enough, or what have you, or passionate enough to finally reach out to them and say, hey, we want your help. We want to be part of that. So it's an integration to me that we're going from, hey, we're going to recruit you. You know who the alumni association, and then when we get there, ultimately they leave a planned gift to us.
Yeah,
We have
look,
a big gray area.
I love it philosophically. I think what you're saying is, look, how do we create value, not just through the education, but through every phase of life, like create value, create relationships, create access to opportunities, meaningful networks. And then also, how do we share in that value as it's created when the time comes from a philanthropic perspective? And I think that's always the challenge in this sector is, unlike a sales organization where you maybe have your ideal customer profile or you have your business segment or it's companies between 100 and 1,000 employees in this industry, in this state, it's very focused. Whereas in your role, in the role of the folks listening here, we've got to figure out how to create value and then share in that value for 22-year-olds and 82-year-olds and everything in between and people who are incredibly affluent and people that are just getting started. There's really no other industry where you have to truly, they always say, hey, we can't be all things to all people. You kind of have to be in a certain in this industry.
It feels like, yeah, it's well, you haven't contacted me this whole time. You have never been contacted. And
I only heard about you when you were calling to ask for money, right?
that's
Like,
right. We hear that all the time. Well, yeah, the only time that the university calls me is when they want to ask for money. If I had a dollar for every one of those conversations, I wouldn't have to be a fundraiser. But it's integrating.
I got to give a shout out to one of my favorite case studies. There's an alumni leader at NC State named Rashonda Mahomes, and Rashonda created a program where, as the alumni leader, when alumni were getting promoted or getting new jobs, we took that list, created a thank you campaign, and her message was, "Congratulations, we're happy for you, we're proud of you." It was like sort of a polar opposite to, "We only hear from you when you're asking for money." And so maybe you all should take that one as you pursue the integrated advancement model. It is so simple,
Yeah.
but it needs to do it and own it, and it needs to be a priority, but it just works really well. People love it.
I think that's a great idea. I'd love to see that because we try to keep up, and whenever someone gets a promotion, I'm writing letters. Hey, just want to let you know, congratulations. Be a lot easier on thank you.
Yeah, and I think, look, there's different levels of personalization, right? Depending
Sure.
on, right, CEO of a Fortune 500 versus maybe somebody getting their early job. But the idea being, hey, when our alumni get promoted, we want them to hear from us, and we want that to be an opportunity to get more.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, it's that, hey, we're here.
Yeah.
We still love you, right?
Yeah, we're glad you're here, right? It's sort
Yeah.
of that motto. So,
Right.
look, I know we're kind of at time, but just you've already sort of shared the process of the building of culture and momentum at Sam Houston State. If people want to be in touch with you, are you hiring? Kind of what should folks keep top of mind?
Yeah, we have a position open, and we'll have a leadership annual giving position open that's coming up pretty soon. I'm going to be hiring for a director for advancement communications, which will be exciting. It's a new position here for this advancement team. So, but they're welcome to reach out to me anytime. It's mapathay@shsu.edu. Even if they want to just ask questions, I get people all the time just saying, it's fun. You talked about mentoring in some of the questionnaires that, I have people that say, hey, my son or daughter's going to go into fundraising. Can they call and ask you questions? And it starts that, hey, I'm always here for you. I'm my door, my phone, whatever is always open to anybody that wants to call. I love talking to people. I love people, and I love building relationships. So, feel free to call me anytime.
But Matt, I've spent a fair amount of time with you, but I feel like I know you better now from
Yeah.
the Rose days to now. Thank you for taking us all on that journey and wishing you the absolute best and grateful for the partnership and look forward to continuing to collaborate with you, Kevin, and the team.
Well, we appreciate you. We appreciate your help. You're helping us be successful, and that's a great partnership. I see the guitar in your background, so someday we'll have to get together and play.
That sounds good to
So.
me. I love it. I love it. All right. With that, I'm going to close. I got some work to do if I'm playing with you. But yes,
It's all good.
I'm going to close today's episode featuring Matt Bethay, who serves as Vice President for University Advancement at Sam Houston State University. Thank you, Matt, and take care, everybody.
Thanks, Brad. Bye-bye.